argument, Lay versus Commonwealth. Ms. Whitley, do you need rebuttal time for your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
And we're ready to begin when you are.
Thank you. May it please the Court again, Lauren Whitley on behalf of Mr. Lee. We're asking this Court to reverse and dismiss Mr. Lee's convictions for custodial indecent liberties on three assignments of error. The first assignment, and I'm just going to kind of go through them as laid out in the brief, is that the trial court erred in finding there was sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Lee because there was no evidence at trial that Mr. Lee was not married to either of the complainants or that the two complainants were not otherwise emancipated. And I would start out just by stating that these two elements are elements of the statute as laid out under custodial indecent liberties. They're listed in the elements section of the statute. They're not affirmative defenses, and they were something that was required to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the Commonwealth in charging these offenses. And there's simply insufficient evidence in the record, even taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, that either of these complainants were not emancipated and or they were not married to Mr. Lee.
Counsel, excuse me, this is Judge mm-hmm. O'Brien. What about the circumstantial evidence from the sister who testified that she hoped that they would get married? Wouldn't that indicate they were not married?
And, Your Honor, I think the difficulty there, and that's certainly what the Commonwealth is arguing, I think the difficulty is that asks this court, and would have asked, but I guess the trial court did make, an unreasonable inference in that testimony. There was no testimony that the sister, because I believe it was the littlest sister, would have been informed or aware of whether or not Mr. Lee and the one complainant had been married. It's simply an unreasonable inference that they're asking this court to make, and the trial court would have had to have made to have found that they were not married, and that's not permissible.
Look, you're asking us to apply the ends of justice exception to Rule 5A18, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it was okay. And now, doesn't that require you to really show that that it's your duty to show affirmatively that an element of the offense did not occur?
Right.
How do you affirmatively show that?
And my argument is that affirmative evidence can also be seen in a simple lack of evidence. So, and I cite in my brief to Thomas against Commonwealth as well as Jimenez against Commonwealth, both where there was a lack of evidence to a specific element of the offenses. So in Thomas against Commonwealth, there was a lack of evidence that the defendant, had been under a written charge of a felony when he was convicted of escape without force. And the court specifically noted that it was the lack of evidence that affirmatively established the insufficient proof of the element. And here I'm arguing the same thing, especially with regards to the element of emancipation, that there is simply lack of evidence in the record that either of these complainants were not emancipated or were not married to Mr. Lee, and that affirmative proof can be seen in that lack of evidence as well. And that's why the ends of justice would be applicable. Jimenez as well, which is a pretty well-founded case in 5A18 ends of justice exception, also deals with a lack of evidence of a written notice requirement for the 15-day notice letter in a construction fraud case.
Does it make any difference that Jimenez is a jury instruction issue?
I mean, I think it's certainly the same type of analytical framework that I would point the court to as far as applying the ends of justice for 5A18. Jimenez was a combination, certainly, of no evidence of a 15-day letter and then an inappropriate instruction to the jury about what was required for the Commonwealth to prove. These were bench trials in these cases, but the same concept for applying the ends of justice applies here, which is when the Commonwealth fails to prove an element that they are charged with proving beyond a reasonable doubt, that is a miscarriage of justice. It's a violative of the defendant's due process rights, and this court should apply the ends of justice in those circumstances to reverse those convictions.
Okay.
And I would point out that it's not, you know, the Commonwealth, it doesn't make it an extremely difficult burden to overcome. That's certainly one of the arguments as to why these are elements of the offenses as opposed to affirmative defenses. It's not that the Commonwealth has to exclude any number of other negative elements or exceptions. It is is simply elements of the offense that they were required to prove, and there's simply no evidence, I would argue, in the record that these complainants weren't married to Mr. Lee or weren't emancipated, and the Commonwealth in its brief is asking this court to make some unreasonable inferences and speculate in order to reach that conclusion, and I would argue that's not proper.
Ms. Whitley, this is Judge Beals. Why isn't, given the ends of justice exception is how you, and I know you weren't trial counsel, but you can see the ends of justice exception is the only way this comes before the court. You have evidence in the record that at the time these first allegations of sexual relations between the appellant and Christina, as well as later with Cheryl, that their mother is bringing them to the Taekwondo studio, that they then go home to live with the mother, and that they have to ask their parents for permission to use the car even after that. Why isn't all of that at least circumstantial evidence that they're not emancipated, let alone married?
And I think the difficulty there is that I would point to the court that in the record there's actually no testimony. They do talk about going home. They do talk about their mom driving them to the Taekwondo studio until they're able to drive, but there's no testimony about where home actually is. And there's no testimony about where they actually live or, what their circumstances are. There is
the argument is that the mom would essentially pick them up from Mr. Lay's home, drive them to Mr. Lay's studio, and wait for them there, and then they have to ask the mom later on, after they're then old enough to drive, for permission to use the car, even though they are married or at least living with Mr. Lay.
Right, and I think the argument, Your Honor, I understand the court's point, but the argument is that that evidence in the record is equally susceptible to circumstances that establish that they were married to him or that they were emancipated. There's really no evidence that firmly establishes that these elements were proven at trial. And I would point the court specifically, Jimenez, I know it is a jury instruction case, but Jimenez, the court specifically notes in Jimenez that despite a face-to-face testimony in the record of a face-to-face interaction between the defendant and the complaining witnesses, there was still not evidence of 15-day notice as required by the statute. So even with that arguably circumstantial evidence in the case that there was a face-to-face interaction between the two parties, the court still found that the ends of justice applied. And I think that's instructive here because despite there being what arguably could be evidence of lack of marriage or lack of emancipation, it's not sufficient, and I would argue it doesn't even rise to the level of circumstantial evidence that would be consistent with those elements being proven. And I also think the difficulty becomes that those circumstances can just as well be interpreted to establish those elements, that he was married to them or that they were emancipated. There's other evidence in the record that supports that. He had access to their text messages and cell phone records. Certainly the evidence that he went to Planned Parenthood and helped them purchase birth control could easily be as interpreted that he was married to the individuals as well as that he was not married to them. And this case law from our Commonwealth, it says, if you have two interpretations, one in favor of the defendant, one in favor of the Commonwealth, of the same set of facts, the trial court cannot arbitrarily adopt those circumstances that convict the defendant versus exculpate him. And I would argue that in this case, that is what the Commonwealth is asking this court to do. That's what the trial court did, in essence, in convicting Mr. Lee, and that is an error and something that should have the ends of justice applied to it.
But if we follow your argument on the ends of justice with regard to the evidence that was in the record here, isn't the ends of justice exception essentially overpowering or subsuming the rule that requires an argument to be made below and not for the first time on appeal?
I don't think that's necessarily true, especially when you have situations such as this case or the case in Thomas or in Jimenez when there is a specific element of the crime that simply wasn't testified to or elicited evidence of by the Commonwealth. I would again point this court to the fact that the Commonwealth is charged with proving each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a due process constitutional right that every defendant has. And when the Commonwealth chooses to bring a charge, they are charged with proving those elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And when the Commonwealth fails to do that in cases, and I don't think that would open the door to a plethora of cases necessarily, because I think cases such as this where there is such little, you know, I argue no real evidence with regard to emancipation, such little evidence with regards to the element of proving a lack of marriage, and in Jimenez and Thomas, the same circumstances, that that's when the ends of justice should be applied. I don't think it opens the door, but I think it allows for a recognition of the constitutional rights the defendant has to be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of each element that's charged by the Commonwealth.
Well, you're welcome to continue. By my clock, you have over 4 minutes remaining if you want to reserve that time.
If I could just briefly speak to the second assignment of error, just talking about the specificity of the criminal offense. You know, I think that I really just want to highlight, and I apologize, I was shuffling through my papers here, that I think there is a requirement under our law that this specificity requirement that comes in sexual assault cases would apply with an intentional touching case, such as what was charged in Mr. Lee's case. And there was a lack of evidence in the record about this indictment period for Christina Krause from the June 30th to the July 30th date, 2004. And I would point the court to Hayes against Commonwealth, as we did in our brief. It is an unpublished case, but it does expand and I think rightly apply the principle that you allege an intentional touching, you have to prove that with specificity, just as you have to prove in a rape case the specificity with a penetration. So with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. You have over 3 minutes remaining. Ms. Baumgartner, we'll be happy to hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm also going to go through the three assignments of error in the order they were in the brief. Regarding the first assignment of error and the preservation, I would disagree that Jimenez and Thomas apply to this case at all. Both of those cases do demonstrate that there must be affirmative evidence. Neither of those cases involved a mere absence of evidence. In fact, Thomas says the evidence affirmatively shows there was no written complaint against Thomas, which was the missing element. And Jimenez also shows that what they were relying on for notice was that face-to-face notice instead of the written notice that was required. So neither of those cases were merely a missing element.
May I ask you this question? Does the Commonwealth dispute that the emancipation and the marriage are elements that the Commonwealth has to prove under the Mayhew factors? I'm just trying to weed out what we have to decide and not decide. Position on that?
The marriage is absolutely an element. I think the case law is clear on that. The emancipation being newly added to the statute is, I'm not sure it's quite so clear because it hasn't made it into the model jury instructions. So while I would say the way it's ordered in the statute makes it look like it's an element, its absence from the model jury instructions suggests that it may not be.
The statute is the statute, and the Model Jury Instructions Committee doesn't make the law. It just writes instructions based on the law. So I'm just trying to figure out. I mean, if you dispute it, that's fine. We have to do the Mayhew analysis and come up with an answer. But if you don't dispute it, then I think we proceed to ends of justice and so on.
Right. I don't think it is clear that it's not an element. And so in this case, we just noted that it wasn't 100% clear like the marriage is. But regardless, I think the evidence does establish it in this case.
Okay.
And on best and narrowest grounds, you don't need to reach that then.
So I'm sorry. I'm a little confused. So you concede that it is an element, but don't think that it would be reached under the analysis of failure to raise it at trial. Is that right?
I think It's unclear, but the court doesn't need to reach whether it's an element or not, because the evidence, because
okay.
it was both unpreserved and because the evidence does establish that they're unemancipated.
So it would be assuming without deciding it's an element, then it's not preserved and ends of justice doesn't apply would be your basic argument.
Correct.
Right.
And all of the defendant's arguments ultimately, regarding the marriage and the emancipation are about, you know, the sufficiency of the evidence. And essentially, Mr. Lee is arguing that if it could go either way, there's a presumption, though, that somehow it's just as reasonable based on all these factors to believe that there was some sort of secret marriage and emancipation, and the Commonwealth just doesn't think that's a reasonable interpretation of the facts, and certainly not enough to overcome the standard of review.
Now, these were both minors, am I correct?
Correct. They were both minors.
Minor marry without parental consent? Is that valid?
They cannot marry without parental consent. And considering that there is evidence in both trials that the girls kept their relationship secret from their parents, at the very least their father, that suggests that there was, in fact, no marriage here because their parents would have had to know to consent. And Mr. Lee's argument in his reply brief that perhaps there was a marriage that was known but a secret sexual relationship is just simply, is just simply not a reasonable interpretation of the facts.
Now, your opposing counsel points out that due process and the federal constitution law requires the Commonwealth to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. So do we have a collision between those principles and our rules of default or not?
I think not. I think that it's the same in every single case where a defendant does not argue specific elements of the crime. The law is pretty clear that ends of justice does not get you around a mere absence of elements of evidence on any sort of element. And I think, that's sort of
is there a case law you can point us to the effect that these basic principles of the adversarial system and the rules of court that govern them don't offend due process, et cetera?
Well, I think if you look at Flanagan, it talks about how a miscarriage of justice is not merely a claimed failure to prove an element. And I think that's essentially what they're arguing, that there's some sort of miscarriage of justice based on due process grounds because of a failure to claim an element. And so, therefore, I think that establishes that there's really not any due process violation because I think a miscarriage of justice and a due process violation, well, not synonymous. I think due process violations are subsumed within the idea of a miscarriage of justice.
Okay.
So I'd also like to address the issue of whether or not they were living together. There was evidence in both trials, specifically talking about the defendant's house being his house and the victims going over to his house, sometimes with their families, sometimes alone. And once again, that's circumstantial evidence that they did not live with him. And also there was a great deal of testimony in both trials about their relationship. And their relationship was both a sexual relationship and a master-student relationship. There was a noted lack of anything that one would consider a marriage relationship in that. Moving on to the second assignment of error about whether or not there was any proof
I'm going
that...
to Judge Beals.
Sure.
Can you give me the Commonwealth's response to the fact, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, that not married is listed as an element in the model jury instruction.
Oh, not married is listed as an element in the model jury instructions. The emancipation is not.
Not covered at all. Is that a problem?
If you mean if there's absolutely no evidence of it at all in the trial?
Right.
I think it's there's only a problem if the defendant objects to it. Otherwise, it's just simply not preserved. And in this case, there was a great deal that was conceded by the defense in opening and at trial. The sexual relationships were conceded. The real issue was whether or not force was required. And there was also a denial that they happened before age 18. I think then by virtue of the defense focusing on whether or not the Commonwealth could prove the time period being before the girls were 18 functions largely as a concession that they were not emancipated. And therefore, the proof was focused on different issues, whereas if this had somehow been raised by the defense as something they were disputing, the proof may have come in differently.
Let me ask you this. Is the fact that, he couldn't have been married to both girls at the same time, obviously.
Correct.
And it is very difficult to, under any circumstance, understand how, even if he were married to one, although these, I guess the sexual activity between him and each of the young women here occurred at different times, right? He would have had
right.
to have gotten a divorce and then married the other one in the meantime. So at what point does a fact finder here have to assume a lot of things in order to believe that there is evidence of marriage?
Well, I would say that these were tried separately. The fact finder, it really wasn't before the fact finder that there were
joint
necessarily
trial.
Sexual relationships with both sisters. But I do think there's a lot that has to be assumed. There's no evidence that he was married to either one at trial. And there's just so much circumstantial evidence between the relationships, between the family and him and this little sister's diary and the parents driving and also the defense case, in focus in part that the mother was at the studio, would have known this was going on because she was always at the studio as team manager. And all of that, I think, allows the fact finder to assume that there is no marriage, certainly if it's not being disputed and all evidence points to there is no marriage between these two. I think at some point when there's no objection regarding that, the fact finder can presume that that is just not a fact in dispute.
Thank you.
And regarding the date about the second assignment of error, the date between June 29th and 2004 and July 30th, 2004, Christina testified that they started having daily sex on May 9th, 2003, every day. And she also testified that between June 29th, 2004 and July 30th, 2004, it was still a sexual relationship that was as frequent as before. That's enough to prove that the indecent liberties occurred during that date. And then in addition to that, we have that she thought she was pregnant, but the defendant arranged for her to get birth control and, in fact, paid for that birth control. All of that is strong evidence that there was a sexual relationship going on, and because of the definition of indecent liberties, it didn't actually have to even be vaginal sex with penetration, the same as rape, but the record certainly suggests that and certainly gives enough evidence for the fact finder. And then third, I'd just like to briefly touch on the force assignment of error. The law does not require force if the General Assembly wanted it in subpart A of the statute, they could have put it in like they did in subparts B and D. The purpose of the statute is to prevent sexual exploitation. That is exactly what occurred in this case. We have someone who taught these girls from when they were young, when they were 5, 6, 8, 10, and essentially groomed them to, at age 16, begin sexual relationships with them. And so force is not necessary here because of the custody and the abuse of trust. The General Assembly certainly didn't put an element of force into this, and this court should not add one either. Are there any further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you. I urge you to affirm.
All right. Thank you very much for that argument. Ms. Whitley, you have a little over 3 minutes left for your rebuttal.
Thank you. And just briefly, I just wanted to touch on a couple arguments that were made by the Attorney General. The first being that there was mention of there was no evidence at trial, and I believe it was an answer to Judge Beal's, one of your questions about at what point can a trial court reasonably infer from the evidence presented. And I would again highlight that these are elements of the offense. In Everett against Commonwealth, this court in it was reviewing the rape statute before it was amended, did state that you cannot take the element of otherwise not the spouse or the lack of marriage into account as judicial notice. It's an element of the offense, must be proven by the Commonwealth. It's their burden to establish that evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And the fact that there was no evidence at trial that they were not otherwise married is not something that was on Mr. Lee to present or to establish. And in this case, as well, the fact that the individuals were minors doesn't necessarily exclude that they could have been married to Mr. Lee. Certainly, if they were emancipated, they then had that right to enter into a marital contract without parental consent. There was no testimony about their status as emancipated or non-emancipated minors. As well, the Commonwealth could easily have called the mother to the stand to testify about a number of these elements or circumstances, and that was not done. That's on the Commonwealth in bringing this charge and not establishing this element beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would certainly argue that a defendant's due process rights are not subsumed by 5A18 and a lack of objection when it comes to the burden on the Commonwealth to prove a case against a defendant. I believe that is was the primary point. I'm happy that I wanted to make on rebuttal. I'm happy to answer any other questions or make any other clarifications about our argument if the court has any. But otherwise, we'd rely on the arguments as laid out in the brief and ask that Mr. Lee's convictions be reversed and dismissed based on the errors by the trial court in these cases.
Any further questions from the panel members?
None for me.
Ms. Whitley, what can the fact finder conclude from the evidence that while this was going on between appellant and first the older sister and then the younger sister, what can the fact finder conclude about the evidence that was also presented that during at least some of that time there was a relationship between the mother and appellant? Does that not add to the totality of the circumstances that can be considered here as to whether the mother would have consented, for example, to a marriage or that even on the question of emancipation? What role can the or what inference can the fact finder make from that?
And I think the difficulty is the fact finder can make a reasonable inference, but when looking at all of the inferences or all of the circumstances, a fact finder cannot make every reasonable inference in favor of the guilt of a defendant, excluding if there are other reasonable inferences that would exculpate the defendant. So, for example, the relationship with the mother. Well, certainly one circumstance or one view of looking at that is, well, you know, the mother would not agree to allow her daughter to marry an individual she was having an affair with. However, there is no evidence in the record that these individuals were not emancipated. That would exclude the mother from having to be involved in the marriage. There's also just no evidence about the familial relationship or what, if any, type of relationship the mother had with these daughters, whether this is something that, you know, there is certainly all different types of families and different types of family interactions. And I think that there's just as much an inference that that could have been something that happened. While not something, you know, that most of us experience, it's certainly an inference that could be made, and it requires the court to, the fact finder, to make all of those inferences in favor of the guilt of the defendant. And I think the case law in the Commonwealth is clear that you can't do that. And I would argue that the inferences do have to be reasonable and certainly in either direction, but if the facts are in equipoise, if you have two interpretations, you can't automatically take those interpretations in favor of convicting the defendant. And I think that's the record that the court has before it now, is that there are inferences that could go either way, and the fact finder erred in finding all of those in favor of the guilt of the defendant.
All right. Thank you both very much for your arguments and for the thoroughness of your briefs. And with that, the court will retire to conference.